Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 860, titled Walking the Snake in Ukraine, Part 7, subtitled All's Well That's Orwell, Part 3. This is being recorded on August 30th of the year 2015. By way of introductory remarks, and I have done a huge amount of programming to date and writing in the descriptions to the programs about the crisis in Ukraine, and we're going to be discussing that still further in this program. For those people who might perhaps be a little tired and or upset that I'm spending this much time on Ukraine, suffice it to say that the political and historical and journalistic and academic dynamics that we will be developing in the course of this program are, I think, at, and maybe this is going to sound a little corny, but I think they could be accurately said to be at the very center of the struggle for our civilization. Because what is taking place in Ukraine at the moment is the complete reconstruction, or as one OUNB sympathetic journalist put it, the reformatting of Ukraine's history with regard to World War II. I love the phraseology, the reformatting of Ukraine's relationship to World War II. I'll give you the exact phrase later. But we are seeing an absolutely Orwellian remaking of the past in order to reconstruct the political present and to direct and inform the political future. And perhaps, not perhaps, but more important and more alarming still than the overt and above ground and legally implemented efforts by the OUNB heirs currently governing Ukraine to remake the fascist past of Ukraine and the fascist nature of the OUNB and its military wing, the UPA, into a democratic, even pro-Jewish elements, is the acceptance of this outside of Ukraine. Really, the OUNB and other Third Reich allied institutions have engaged in this sort of Holocaust denial and, or Holocaust revisionism, I should say, and this fundamental perversion of history and politics. But what has not been, at least broadly evident, is the acceptance on the part of far too much of Western journalism and the Western diplomatic establishments of this OUNB narrative. We're going to begin with an article from The Nation magazine about the Institute of National Memory. And if that sounds Orwellian, well, it bloody well is, and its function is Orwellian. What that is a Ukrainian government institution that was housed at the old Ukrainian KGB archives building. And what it is doing is completely reconstructing the World War II history of Ukraine, and indeed the history of Ukrainian nationalism dating back to World War I. Ukraine had been part of the Western Ukraine, had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Ukraine as a nation became, quote, independent, unquote, after World War I, and then following a series of brutal wars and civil wars became part of the former Soviet Union. We're going to talk about an early Ukrainian nationalist and anti-Semite named Simon Petliura. It is difficult, well, I think for contemporary Americans, perhaps past the point impossible, to understand what was going on in Eastern Europe during the latter part of World War I and the early post-World War I period. To make a very long story very short, it was a hell broth. And yet that hell broth is being reconstructed as very nourishing chicken soup by the authorities in Ukraine. We're going to be looking at that, and we're also, time permitting, going to review the evolution of the OUNB Third Reich Allied Ukrainian Fascist Organization from the pre-World War II period, where there was a very, or during which there was a very virulent Ukrainian fascist underground in the U.S., and then through World War II, through the Cold War, when the OUNB jumped to the CIA, the BND, elements of MI6, and to the Republican Party. It was nourished within the bowels of those institutions and then projected back into Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union during the closing phase of the Cold War and the breakup of the Soviet Union. Even those relatively few journalistic organs that have been willing to cite the presence in the Ukrainian fighting or the Ukrainian order of battle of explicitly Nazi combatant organizations like the Azov Battalion, they have tended to engage consciously or otherwise in what is known in intelligence parlance as modified limited hangout. They're talking about the neo-Nazis in Ukraine. But in fact, the organizations like Svoboda, its combat wing or its military wing, Combat 14, Pravi Sektor, the Azov Battalion, and others, are marching to a tune that has been called by the successors to the OUNB. The OUNB became the dominant element in the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and the former World Anti-Communist League. It became part of the Republican Ethnic Heritage Outreach Council, became a key part of the Republican Party, and became a significant element of the Reagan administration as well. The OUNB crops up very prominently in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy, and it is all but certain that elements of that organization were actually involved in the assassination itself. They were certainly involved as disinformation agents in the wake of the assassination, some of them operating before the assassination of JFK, suggesting pre-knowledge of the event and consequent complicity. The government of Viktor Yushchenko, which came to power during the so-called Orange Revolution, featured not only Viktor Yushchenko, but his wife, Ekaterina Yushchenko, formerly Ekaterina Shumachenko, who had been the director of public liaison for Ronald Reagan. She was a member of the UCCA, that's the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, the largest OUNB front organization in the U.S. The head of that organization, a guy named Lev Dobryansky, was Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas. Interestingly, the Bahamas were a major epicenter of the Bank al-Taqwa and the funding efforts for the Afghan Mujahideen that helped to bring down the former Soviet Union. One wonders to what extent Lev Dobryansky's presence in the Bahamas was tied to the Afghan Mujahideen effort. In any event, Yaroslav Stetsko was the wartime leader of, quote, independent Ukraine, unquote. It was actually a Nazi puppet state. He then became the head of the OUNB and the ABN. He passed away in 1986, and his wife, Slava Stetsko, became the head of the OUNB. Yaroslav Stetsko's personal secretary in the early 1980s, a guy named Roman Zvorich, went on to form the Ukrainian National, or the Congress of Ukrainian Nationalists, along with Slava Stetsko. He was, Roman Zvorich, that is, Stetsko's personal secretary, was the Minister of Justice of Ukraine under both Tymoshenko governments and the Yushchenko government, and that's equivalent of the Attorney General in the U.S., and he is an advisor to Poroshenko. It was Viktor Yushchenko who established the Institute for National Memory and appointed a guy named Volodymyr Vyacholovich, an OUNB activist born in the western Ukrainian city of Lvov, to head up the Institute for National Memory. The Institute for National Memory will no doubt sound absolutely Orwellian. It is just exactly that. Its explicit purpose is to recreate or reformat, as one pro-OUNB journalist put it, Ukraine's relationship to the Second World War. It is, in fact, a propaganda body that is in the process of implementing a totalitarian fascist history of Ukraine and Ukrainian nationalism. And, well, the Orwellian nature of that institution is quite explicit. Poroshenko, whom, as we saw in For the Record 800, and as we will be examining again today, Poroshenko pretty much reconstituted the old Yushchenko team. He didn't marry Ekaterina Yushchenko, but he put many of the same Yushchenko advisors in power. He is taking advice from Roman Zvarych, Yaroslav Stetsko's personal secretary in the early 80s, and he has reappointed Volodymyr Vyacholovich as head of the Institute of National Memory. And again, what is so significant about this is the fact that many in the West, both journalistic and scholarly institutions and political institutions as well, are basically accepting the narrative that is being presented in Ukraine as fact. And in fact, it is anything but that. Among the things that move me to do this particular program at this particular time was a recording I heard this past week of an address that President Barack Obama gave to a Jewish audience of some kind. He was in the process of trying to sell his nuclear deal with Iran. And to this Jewish audience, he mentioned correctly that Iran was a country that denied the Holocaust. At least the government of Ahmadinejad did just that. It held a conference of international Holocaust deniers. And one of the attendants at that Holocaust denial conference held by then Iranian President Ahmadinejad was none other than David Duke. David Duke is a professor, a teacher at the MAUP-sponsored university in Ukraine. MAUP is M-A-U-P. It is a Ukrainian acronym. I am not going to attempt the actual pronunciation of that. Suffice it to say that MAUP finances the largest private university in Ukraine with something like 57,000 students. Former President Viktor Yushchenko was on the board of advisors, and David Duke is a member of that faculty. And David Duke has been able to wield a fair amount of intellectual influence in Ukraine as a result of the MAUP connection. So when you hear Barack Obama correctly citing Iran, or at least the Ahmadinejad government, as a Holocaust-denying country, that is quite true. But bear in mind that Ukraine is as well. And so far, Barack Obama, although standing up to some of the right-wing efforts to overtly involve the U.S. militarily in Ukraine beyond simply the training of some of their National Guard units, Obama has not come out and basically told it like it is, which is that we have the OUNB back in power in Ukraine. On the contrary, in the West, Russian President Vladimir Putin's claims that the people in power in Ukraine are fascist is dismissed with contemptuous mirth. And in fact, Putin is absolutely correct. These are the willful, explicit, even celebratory heirs to the OUNB World War II fascist government. And in the presence of people like Roman Svarich and Ekaterina Tymoshenko Yushchenko, we have actual living institutional links or personal links to the OUNB. So when you hear Obama correctly identifying and excoriating Iran as a Holocaust-denying country, bear in mind that at this time, not only the U.S. and the Obama administration, but other Western so-called democracies are stepping, and I guess one could say goose-stepping, to the tune sounded by Volodymyr Vyatrovich and the Institute of National Memory. So again, the continuity of the OUNB through the Cold War, through the Reagan administration, and through the Crusade for Freedom, which I've spoken about in past programs, right on up to the present, is something to be borne in mind. And again, what is so remarkable about this is not that the OUNB would be doing something like this. This is the kind of thing that they have been espousing for decades. But to see the admittedly propagandized, and at least in the U.S., the seriously dumbed-down journalistic, academic, and political establishments going along with this, at least tacitly, is remarkable. The title Walking the Snake in Ukraine, of course, refers to the Nazi-cracked serpent's walk in which the SS go underground, which they did, build up their economic muscle, which they did, and buy into Western opinion-forming media, ultimately taking over the U.S. and perverting history in a pro-Hitler fashion.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
So beginning with the first of our articles, this is from The Nation magazine of August 13th of the year 2015. It's by Jared, J-A-R-E-D, McBride, M-C-B-R-I-D-E. How Ukraine's new memory commissar is controlling the nation's past. The subtitle, Volodymyr Vyatrovich was the driving force behind new laws that restrict free speech and regulate how history is written. By the way, the new law in Ukraine making it a criminal offense to criticize the OUNB or UPA, including mentioning their work on behalf of and as allies of Nazi Germany. That was instituted by a guy named Yuri Shukhevich, who is the son of Roman Shukhevich, who was the head of the UPA, the military wing of the OUNB. Again, from The Nation of August 13th of 2015 by Jared McBride, how Ukraine's new memory commissar is controlling the nation's past, and discussing Volodymyr Vyatrovich. Skipping down, it is alarming that some Western journalists, scholars, and policymakers are embracing a nationalist version of Ukrainian history that resonates only with part of Ukrainian society and not at all with serious academic discourse in Europe and North America. Front and center in the efforts to produce a nationalist version of Ukrainian history is the former director of the country's secret police archives and new director of the Institute of National Memory, or UINP, under the current government of President Petro Poroshenko. That man is Volodymyr Volodymyr Vyatrovich, V-I-A-T-R-O-V-Y-C-H. And by the way, he was appointed as head of the newly created Institute of National Memory by Viktor Yushchenko. The continuity from Yushchenko to Poroshenko is front and center here, and in turn, the Yushchenko government was something of a repository for the OUNB's personnel policy, and institutions dating all the way back to the pre-World War II and the World War II periods. Speaking of Volodymyr Vyatrovich, returning to the Nation article by Jared McBride. Vyatrovich, born 1977, from the western Ukrainian city of Lviv, first stepped onto the national scene when he was put in charge of the archive section of the newly created Institute of National Memory in 2008, and then head of the SBU archives later that year. By the way, the SBU, I'm not going to attempt the Ukrainian pronunciation of that. That was the Ukrainian branch of the old KGB. And what was basically done and what is being done is to put people like Volodymyr Vyatrovich in charge of those archives and to taint any legitimate identification of the OUNB as Nazi allied and doctrinaire fascists and mass murderers, which they were, as Soviet propaganda, a part of the Orwellian and serpent's walk nature of what we are seeing in Ukraine, is basically using anti-communism as a vehicle for justifying fascism and the complete perversion of the past. Ultimately, I think that if this trend continues, and I'm afraid it is going to, maybe a couple hundred years, maybe 300 years from now, Adolf Hitler's birthday will be an international holiday, and he will be seen as something of a vanguard, someone who was out in front and ahead of his time in combating the Jewish and Bolshevik international menace. And we'll see how that plays out. But I'm afraid that is where things are going. And again, watching the lockstep or goose-step, as it were, of Western journalistic, scholarly, and political institutions and individuals, watching them conforming to the Institute of National Memory in Ukraine and the efforts of Volodymyr Vyatrovich is, well, it's frightening and sadly, something that is not altogether unexpected. It's why maybe some people are wondering, why in the world does Dave keep talking about that obscure book, Serpent's Walk? This is why, okay? I read Serpent's Walk at the time that the O.J. Simpson case was going on in the U.S., and I realized that basically what Serpent's Walk is a blueprint for the future. Returning again to the Nation article and the efforts of Volodymyr Vyatrovich, newly appointed to head the Institute of National Memory by Poroshenko. He had previously been installed as head of that institution by Viktor Yushchenko, and the continuity from Yushchenko to Poroshenko is front and center. Vyatrovich, McBride writes, in these influential positions, he helped in the effort to, quote, exonerate, unquote, a key World War II Ukrainian nationalist leader of any complicity in the Holocaust, presented the nationalist Ukrainian insurgent army as a democratic organization open to Jewish members, and focused heavily on Ukrainian victimization during the famine of the 1930s, while interestingly also blaming Jews as perpetrators. Vyatrovich has made a name for himself as a political activist by instrumentalizing his scholarly credentials. Both before and after his Secret Service archive tenure, he was the head of the Center for the Study of the Liberation Movement in Lviv. The research center is funded by private money from Ukrainian groups abroad that have helped to shape its research agenda. The unambiguous goal of the center is to paint the Ukrainian nationalists, in particular the OUN and the UPA, two of the most important Ukrainian nationalist organizations from the interwar and World War II period, as, quote, liberators, unquote, from Soviet, Polish, and German oppression. Radical right-wing Ukrainian nationalists are depicted as nothing but tragic freedom fighters, occasionally forced to don Nazi uniforms to struggle for independence, liberty, and Western values. This is the party line at the center, one largely shaped by Vyatrovich. And again, the OUN and the UPA were fascist organizations. They were allied with Nazi Germany. And under the direction of Stefan Bandera and Jaroslav Stetsko, carried out Nazi-style liquidations of their, quote, ethnic or religious enemies and political enemies during the Second World War. They slaughtered the Poles, Jews, Russians, Roma or Gypsies, and anyone whose politics they disagreed with, including and especially people who were either communist or socialist. People who were of sincere democratic with a small d sentiment were liquidated as well. Continuing, Fyodorovich's own scholarly output echoes the goals of his center. In a number of publications, he has covered a laundry list of flashpoints in 20th century Ukrainian history, from the vicious anti-Jewish pogroms of World War I through Ukrainian-Polish violence during and after World War II. What unifies his approach is a relentless drive to exculpate Ukrainians of any wrongdoing, no matter the facts. For example, concerning Ukrainian nationalist involvement in the Holocaust, in Fyodorovich's world, collaboration never happened or was coerced, and at any rate can't be blamed on nationalism. All evidence to the contrary is blithely assigned to Soviet lies. On the nationalist ethnic cleansing of Poles in 1943-44, Fyodorovich lets us know that that was a sort of tragic but symmetrical warfare. As we all know, war is cruel and bad things happen. When confronted with the fact that the head of UPA, Roman Shukhevich, served the Nazis until 1943 as commander of a mobile police battalion that murdered thousands of civilians in Belarus, Fyodorovich responded, quote, "Is it possible to consider Poles or Bielorussians a peaceful population if during the day they work as ordinary villagers, only to arm themselves in the evening and attack the village? In other words, civilians are fair targets, especially for, quote, heroes, unquote, of Ukraine in the service of Nazis." In the academic world, such tactics have their limits. But when confronted with solid archival evidence contrary to his stories, such as orders from OUN-UPA leadership to cleanse the Polish population of Volhynia, Fyodorovich simply claims that those documents are Soviet forgeries, or that scholars challenging him are serving sinister propaganda purposes. Selectivity rules. If there is no smoking gun document for nationalist crimes, it is exculpatory. When there is no smoking gun document for premeditated Soviet genocide against Ukrainians, it's a result of KGB cunning. Fyodorovich deals with video testimonial archives and the integration of witness testimony into history with bravado, simply ignoring them, and especially Jewish voices, altogether when he dislikes what they have to tell us. This abysmal ethical and methodological approach has been challenged by scholars from Poland, Scandinavia, Germany, Canada, and the U.S., in addition to a few brave Ukrainian ones. These scholars have written excoriating reviews of his works. Unlike his writings, these reviews were published in peer-reviewed journals. There are no career repercussions for poor scholarship when you are a political activist. Thanks to his credentials as, quote, former SBU archive director, unquote, director of a prominent, quote, research, unquote, institute, and a brief stint as a research fellow at the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute, or HURI, which show up in every bio blurb possible, Fyodorovich is cited frequently in the Ukrainian media. Ironically, as he has gained more negative attention from scholars, he has traversed a different arc in Ukraine, increasingly trusted as a voice of wisdom, a fresh young force promising to defend and promote Ukraine's history, here understood as the glorious record of Ukrainian nationalism. It was no surprise when in late 2014, President Poroshenko chose him as head of the Ukrainian Institute of National Memory, a government body originally created by then-President Yushchenko to support research and forge a national memory policy. Fyodorovich wasted little time after this appointment. He became the driving force behind the so-called decommunization laws that were put on the books this spring. In reality, these laws regulate how history should be written and place restrictions on free speech, and thus are deeply at odds with Kiev's claims to Western values. Law number 2538-1, quote, on the legal status and honoring of fighters for Ukraine's independence in the 20th century, unquote, states that, again quoting, the public denial of the just cause of the fighters for Ukrainian independence in the 20th century insults the dignity of the Ukrainian people and is illegal, unquote. The fighters for Ukrainian independence explicitly include the World War II nationalists of the OUN and UPA. In essence, this law makes it at least very risky to criticize them or point out the crimes in which they participated. I would point out against this should be seen against the background of a wave of very suspicious deaths of people opposed to the Poroshenko government or the OUN and UPA heirs. We talked about that for the record, 850, skipping down. Law number 2540, quote, on access to the archives of repressive organizations of the communist totalitarian regime from 1917 to 1991, unquote, puts all secret police archives under the control of the National Memory Institute in Kiev, headed by Viatrovich. Again, any documentation of what the OUNB or the UPA were doing will be dismissed as Kremlin propaganda, or today, Russian propaganda.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing in, but by no means exclusively, economic and financial matters.
Skipping down. Sadly, the Ukrainian diaspora scholarly community in North America has often supported these restrictive laws. Parenthetically, that should come as no surprise whatsoever. Regarding Viatrovich, they see no problem with having a partisan political activist in charge of the country's secret police archives, rather than foreign scholars and their insensitive research, unquote, agendas that discuss the dark spots of Ukraine's history are the real problem for Ukraine. In a recent roundtable interview with two well-known scholars and one member of the Ukrainian-American community, Western scholars were described as, quote, neo-Soviet, unquote, and their response as, quote, quasi-hysterical, unquote. In a misplaced post-colonial twist, the, quote, propriety or authority of foreigners to instruct Ukraine's elected representatives as to whom they wish to acknowledge or memorialize and why was questioned. The laws were praised as the answer to outside tampering in Ukraine's history. On the issue of free speech, there was hedging. In an altogether Orwellian key, Alexander Motyl, M-O-T-Y-L, a political scientist at Rutgers University in Newark, went so far as to compare Ukraine's history-regulating laws to civil rights laws, women's rights, and laws protecting the gay community in the United States. This is not the first time Motyl's analogies to U.S. history have caused shock in various scholarly communities. There has been little controversy in the West about putting Ukraine's secret police archives in Viatrovich's hands. The response from Ukrainian intelligentsia have ranged from joy to muted concern about privacy issues. Motyl excitedly called the archives law a, quote, coup for freedom and justice, unquote. Unsurprisingly, given that he is perhaps the only scholar to have praised Viatrovich's recent book. Outside of perspective pieces in Ukrainian by Vasil Rasevich, R-A-S-E-V-Y-C-H, an historian and writer, and Stanislav Serienko, an activist and writer about the dangers of archive tampering, few commentators, including those in the West, seem to worry about the potential manipulation of the archives. The dialectics of national liberalism aside, Motyl's term coup, unquote, is an appropriate Freudian slip. We might ask ourselves why a nation's most politically sensitive document collection should be entrusted with a political activist interested in one and only one version of the past, rather than putting them under the auspices of the Central State Archive Administration, skipping down. if the response from the diaspora-oriented scholarly community to the laws and via Trovich's appointment has been scandalous, the naivete with which some Western observers have embraced the nationalist narrative is even more troubling. Following the Maidan Revolution, Viatrovich is now cited as a voice of knowledge in the Ukrainian and Western media. The Christian Science Monitor has quoted him in an article about Ukraine's past, where he explained that to dispel myths, unquote, Ukraine should, quote, create an open national dialogue, unquote. With no acknowledgement or probably knowledge of Viatrovich's background as a myth-maker-in-chief himself, the article uncritically presents him as a voice for the future. Even more egregious was the article Is There a Future for Ukraine? By Peter Pomerantsev, a journalist and producer who frequently writes on Russia, which appeared in the Atlantic magazine of July of 2014. Pomerantsev interviewed and profiled Viatrovich as a carrier of hope for Ukraine's future. Pomerantsev has managed to recognize in Viatrovich a liberal nationalist, unquote, working to, quote, create a Ukrainian identity, unquote. Strange praise for a man claiming to be a scholar, a profession usually engaged in open-ended inquiry, not identity building. Pomerantsev tells his readers that Viatrovich is, quote, best known for his work on reformatting Ukraine's relationship to the Second World War, which is both an understatement and a horribly revealing choice of terms. Again, this sentence, this is vintage Orwell. Pomerantsev tells his readers that Viatrovich, quote, is best known for his work on reformatting Ukraine's relationship to the Second World War, which is both an understatement and a horribly revealing choice of terms. In his mostly uncritical portrayal, he writes that Viatrovich, quote, believes he can help bridge these divisions in Ukrainian society and create a story that is at once nationalist and integrationist. When asked about a positive unifying message, Viatrovich matter-of-factly tells him that Russians want tyranny and Ukrainians want freedom, unquote, skipping down again. And again, note the, not skipping down, but restating an important passage. Viatrovich has made a name for himself as a political activist by instrumentalizing his scholarly credentials. Both before and after his Secret Service tenure, he was the head of the Center for the Study of the Liberation Movement in Lvov. The research center is funded by private money from Ukrainian groups abroad that have helped to shape its research agenda. The unambiguous goal of that center is to paint the Ukrainian nationalists, in particular the OUN and UPA, two of the most important Ukrainian nationalist organizations from the interwar and World War II period, as liberators, unquote, from Soviet, Polish, and German oppression. And we're briefly going to review the creation of the Institute for National Memory and the initial installation of Volodymyr Viatrovich as its head. Now, again, bear in mind that this is under the Yushchenko government. Viktor Yushchenko had married Ekaterina Chumachenko from the UCCA, the top OUNB front organization in the U.S. She was Reagan's deputy director of public liaison. The head of that group, Lev Dobryansky, was Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas. Dobryansky's daughter, Paulette Dobryansky, was on Reagan's National Security Council. She then was made an assistant secretary of state by George W. Bush. And among other things, recalling our interviews with Peter Lavenda, she was in charge of the Tibet desk for the State Department. And for the record, 781, we put a section of a chapter of a book called Analyzing Fascist Discourse, European Fascism in Talk and Text. It's edited by Ruth Woldak, W-O-D-A-K, and John E. Richardson, published in London and New York by Routledge Books. And there is a chapter, The Return of the Ukrainian Far Right, The Case of V.O. Svoboda, by Per Anders Rudling, a professor at Lund, L-U-N-D, University in Sweden. Oh, by the way, notice some of the Orwellian language at work, even in the critics of these kinds of things. Jared McBride, for example, at no point identified OUN or UPA as fascist, which they are. And indeed, Per Anders Rudling steers clear of that to a certain extent. At times he does. He puts OU, actually it's not so much Per Anders Rudling as the editors here, but you'll notice that they don't call these organizations fascist. If Adolf Hitler came back to life today, the way he would be covered, he would be called the German paleoconservative Adolf Hitler, whom critics accuse of pursuing an ultra-nationalist agenda. That's how they would phrase it. And of the Orange Revolution, Viktor Yushchenko and his institution of what Per Anders Rudin calls Yushchenkoism, which is really pro-OUNB, UPA revisionism, we read as follows, again from Analyzing Fascist Discourse, European Fascism in Talk and Text. This chapter, The Return of the Ukrainian Far-Right, the Case of Vio Svoboda. Swept to power by the Orange Revolution, the third president of Ukraine, Viktor Yushchenko, put substantial efforts into the production of historical myths. He tasked a set of nationalistically minded historians to produce and disseminate an edifying national history as well as a new set of national heroes. The OUN wings disagreed on strategy and ideology, but shared a commitment to the manufacture of an historical past based on victimization and heroism. The émigré developed an entire literature that denied the OUN's fascism, its collaboration with Nazi Germany, and its participation in atrocities, instead presenting the organization as composed of Democrats and pluralists who imported a narrative developed by the émigrés. As president, Yushchenko initiated substantial government propaganda initiatives. In July of 2005, he established an Institute of National Memory, assigned the archives of the former KGB formal propagandistic duties, and supported the creation of a museum of Soviet occupation in Kiev. Yushchenko appointed the young activist Volodymyr Vyatrovich, director of the SBU archives. Vyatrovich combined his position as government-appointed memory manager with ultra-nationalist activism. He was simultaneously director of an OUNB front organization, the Center for the Study for the Liberation Movement. State institutions disseminated a sanitized, edifyingly patriotic version of the history of the, quote, Ukrainian National Liberation Movement, the leaders of which were presented in iconographic form as heroic and saintly figures, martyrs of the nation. Yushchenko's myth-making had two central components. The first was presentation of the 1932-33 famine as, quote, the genocide of the Ukrainian nation. The other component was a heroic cult of the OUNB, the UPA, and their leaders. The memory managers juxtaposed the genocidal Soviet rule with the self-sacrificial heroism of the OUN-UPA, producing a teleological narrative of suffering, the famine, and resistance, the OUN-UPA, leading to redemption. Curiously, Yushchenko's legitimizing historians presented their instrumentalized use of history as, quote, truth, unquote, which they juxtaposed to Soviet myths, unquote. Wilfried Jilge, J-I-L-G-E, an historian at the University of Leipzig, writes, a quote, it takes place by means of discourse, rituals, and symbols, and uses the past to provide legitimization and to mobilize the population for political purposes. Skipping down. A reconstructed historical memory is created as true memory and then contrasted with false Soviet history. Thus, Valentin Novichenko, SBU director under Yushchenko, described the task of his agency as being to disseminate, quote, the historical truth of the past of the Ukrainian people, unquote, to, quote, liberate Ukrainian history from lies and falsifications and to work with truthful documents only, unquote. Ignoring the OUN's anti-Semitism, denying its participation in anti-Jewish violence, and overlooking its fascist ideology, Novichenko and his agency presented the OUN as Democrats, pluralists, even righteous rescuers of Jews during the Holocaust. Skipping down. So, for instance, can academic works on World War II by reputable historians integrate the works of Holocaust deniers and cite the former KKK Grand Wizard David Duke as an expert on the Jewish question? This, again, in Ukrainian textbooks, skipping down. The culmination of Yushchenko's Geschichtspolitik was his designation a few days before leaving office of Bandera as a hero of Ukraine. And again, most of this chapter is included in the description for the record 860. And again, this is vintage Orwell. And what I find so significant about this is not that this would be going on. This is what the OUNB in the U.S. and Germany and elsewhere have been doing all along. But the fact that this is now becoming the journalistic, historical, and political narrative in that is accepted in the West.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site also features many articles not included in programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Part of the historical revisionism that is now going on in Ukraine, in addition to revising the history of the OUNB and UPA explicitly, an early figure in Ukrainian nationalist, fascist, and anti-Semitic history, a guy named Semyon or Simon Petliura is being rehabilitated as well. You'll see that name like many Ukrainian names, which are transliterated from the Cyrillic alphabet. You'll see that spelled different ways. Simon, you'll see S-Y-M-O-N or S-Y-M-E-O-N. Petliura, you'll see P-E-T-L-I-U-R-A or L. Y-U-R-A. He was one of the early figures in Ukrainian nationalism and really was sort of an early fascist. And he was very well known for leading some murderous pogroms against the Jewish population of Ukraine in the late World War I and post-World War I periods, the immediate aftermath of World War I in particular. He was ultimately assassinated by a Ukrainian Jew whose family had been killed in those pogroms. What's worth noting, is the political rehabilitation of Simon Petliura, who was a blood-drenched pogromist in the worst traditions of Eastern European anti-Semitism, and is a hero to the OUN-UPA crowd. And as we will see, one of the things that has helped the political revisionism with regard to Simon Petliura is the fact that Vladimir Yabotinsky, the head of the Beitar, one of the fascist elements in the Zionist movement, and again, I'm not claiming that the Zionist movement is fascist, but the Beitar, sure as bloody hell was, they were military allies of Mussolini, and they held a doctrinaire racist and anti-labor stance, and that Vladimir Yabotinsky proposed an abortive alliance with Simon Petliura is very revealing. From an article called The Ukrainian Regime of Yushchenko Rehabilitates Simon Petliura by Felix Kreisel, K-R-E-I-S-E-L, from the MIT.edu website of June 8th of 2006, we read the following about Yushchenko and Simon Petliura. Yushchenko's government announced that during the 80th anniversary year since his death, the government will put a monument to Simon Petliura, the chief ataman of the Ukrainian People's Republic. During the week around this anniversary, Petliura died in Paris on May 25, 1926, that took place in Kiev, a series of events to commemorate his life in which the president of Ukraine, Yushchenko, and members of his cabinet took part. A film was shown at the National Opera, an exhibit was displayed at the National Museum of Ukrainian History, a requiem service was staged at the St. Basil Cathedral, and so on, skipping down. 8 years ago, on May 25th, 1926, on a street in Paris, a 40-year-old Ukrainian Jew, Shalom Schwartzbard, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z-B-A-R-B, approached a middle-aged person and asked in Ukrainian whether he was Mr. Petliura. Upon receiving confirmation, Schwartzbard shot Petliura point-blank a number of times, ecstatically shouting, quote, "This is for the pogroms. This is for the murders. This is for your victims," and killed the chief ataman of the Ukrainian national government during the years 1919 and 1920. Schwartzbard did not try to flee, and when the policeman ran over, he surrendered his weapon to him, saying, quote, "You can arrest me. I killed an executioner." Ultimately, by the way, Schwartzbard, who was viewed with considerable international sympathy, was acquitted. An article we've used in For the Record 824 by George Eliason from Op-Ed News of August 1st of 2014, Ukraine, Why Bandera Had the Largest Geopolitical Voice in EU, uses Bandera in a collective application here to the various Eastern European fascist organizations that comprise the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations and antecedent organizations like the Promethean League, about which we have spoken. Talking about Petliura, Eliason writes, Simon Petliura was one of the original leaders of the Habsburg countries to sign on to Prometheanism. But even as the recognized dictator of Ukraine, he was forced to move the government into exile. The only acceptable form of government to a Ukrainian is the Galician model of extreme ultranationalism. Petliura is revered as a hero in Western Ukraine and a butcher everywhere else for his pogroms, torture, and murder. And skipping down to the rehabilitation of Petliura, that was what Maidan was about. When Poroshenko gave his inaugural address, he paid homage to this fact. He said that the wars of 1917 to 1920 had finally been won. This was acknowledged by his election. This new Ukraine was now under the laws and traditions of 1920s Ukraine, as demanded by Simeon Petliura. This was finally the Ukraine they had been waiting for. I will also note that the Congress of Ukrainian Nationalists praises Vladimir Yabotinsky. I talked about that in For the Record 800. I did not know why. I suspected that it was to deflect charges of anti-Semitism, which it certainly is. I thought when I recorded that program that it was because of Yabotinsky and the Beitar's alliance with Mussolini prior to World War II. Eventually, that alliance was dissolved. It turns out that Yabotinsky had actually proposed an abortive alliance with Simon Petliura. An article by Shlomo Avineri in the Haaretz newspaper of July 19th of 2009. Yabotinsky's Embarrassing Offer by Shlomo, again, Shlomo Avineri. Skipping down, Petliura's name is barely known today in Israel, yet before the Nazis' rise to power, it represented murderous anti-Semitism. The pogroms in Ukraine were one of the factors that pushed Jews into the ranks of the Red Army, which waged war against Ukrainian nationalism. Ukrainian nationalists, on the other hand, viewed Schwartzbard's act of assassination as part of a Jewish Bolshevist conspiracy. What is less known is that after the fall of Petliura's regime, none other than Zev Yabotinsky signed an agreement with him in 1921. Skipping down, after independent Ukraine was defeated by the Red Army, Petliura found refuge in Poland, which had fought against Soviet Russia. He planned to return to Ukraine at the head of an army of exiled expatriates. Yabotinsky suggested that Petliura enlist units of Jewish soldiers. Clearly, Yabotinsky's rabid anti-communism was one reason behind the proposal. Publicly, he rationalized the offer by claiming that the Jewish divisions in Petliura's army would defend the Jewish population from possible pogroms. The suggestion allowed Petliura to claim that he was not anti-Semitic, that the pogroms were simply unfortunate events that had occurred in the heat of battle. So again, it was that brief alliance, the agreement in 1921 between Yabotinsky and Petliura, that has been used as part of the political rehabilitation of Petliura, an early sort of template leader for the OUNB and UPA. In the description for the Record 860, we review an article from the World Post, that is an international version of the Huffington Post, by Nicholas Kozlov. Ukraine, World War II fiasco leads to public relations disaster and thorny relations for Kiev and the foreign diaspora. It talks about both Viktor Yushchenko and his heir, Petro Poroshenko, placing Rees at the Babi Yar, the site of the Babi Yar massacres, in honor of the OUN. The Babi Yar was a ravine, is a ravine in Ukraine, at which scores of thousands of Jews, gypsies, and others were machine-gunned over a period of years. Most of the executions, roughly two-thirds of them, were from the OUNB. And yet both Yushchenko and Poroshenko went to Babi Yar not to honor the victims, but to place wreaths in honor of the OUN. That would be like going to Auschwitz and placing a wreath in honor of the SS. It is quite remarkable. Also, in the description for this program is an article reviewing from Deutsche Welle, reviewing how Poroshenko has reconstituted the government of Yushchenko. It should come as no surprise whatsoever that the Azov Battalion, one of the openly Nazi military units in the Ukrainian National Guard, is training a youth wing. From the Daily Mail of August 12th of 2015 by Stephen Cockroft, C-O-C-K-R-O-F-T. Shocking pictures from inside neo-Nazi military camp reveal recruits as young as six are being taught how to fire weapons, even though there's a ceasefire. Now, extremists from the Azov unit, a far-right neo-Nazi militia defending the port city of Mariupol in southeastern Ukraine, are teaching children as young as six how to fire guns in an attempt to entice them into the country's bloody conflict. Disturbing pictures have emerged from a military summer camp held on the outskirts of Kiev, which show members of the voluntary group teaching so-called Azov vets how to behave as young fighters. The children, which include girls and boys, some as young as six, are seen loading their guns before taking part in exercises in which they crawl along the ground and fire at the enemy. The camp comes under the command of Andrei Beletsky, who once admitted that the battalion do not like the ceasefire at all. Also in the description for the Record 860 is an article that we will deal with at some length in an upcoming program, perhaps in 861, from the Consortium News website of August 17th of 2015. Ray McGovern has an article, Propaganda, Intelligence, and MH17. McGovern himself is a former CIA intelligence analyst, and one of the things he's pointing out is that if in the roughly 13 months since Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 was shot down over Ukraine, there was evidence that had been amassed that supported the West's version of the, well, the Putin did it version, then it would almost certainly have been brought to light. The fact that there has been no disclosure, no discussion at all from the anti-Russian, anti-Putin camp about information that they had gathered since the shootdown suggests very strongly that, in fact, the information that they have gathered does not support their initial conclusions. Again, the title of the article, Propaganda, Intelligence, and MH17 by Ray McGovern of Consortium News of August 17th, 2015. The article is in the description for the Record 860. We will deal with the article itself in an upcoming broadcast, but we are all out of time. This concludes For the Record program number 860, Walking the Snake in Ukraine, Part 7, subtitled All's Well That's Orwell, Part 3. This is being recorded on August 30th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.